Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Tom, Restaurant Wars has come early to Top Chef.
And this time, sadly, we're not hammered drunk off of rosé and sweating our tails off in Lexington. Very sad.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haverstraw.
Tom, total curveball by the good team at Top Chef. Restaurant Wars got going a week early. Very interesting little development. I don't know how I feel, and I'll get to this in a second. I'm a little conflicted, but what say you?
Yeah, it was definitely a curveball. I actually I was surprised because it wasn't front of mind when I started watching, because I thought this was Restaurant Wars episode, and it didn't occur to me that once the quickfire came out, I was like, wait, that means that today's not Restaurant Wars. And then they, you know, slowly gave that reveal. I was kind of bummed out because I think in my head I was getting sunk down into my couch ready for Restaurant Wars. And it's a 2-day Restaurant Wars. And I'm, you know, I don't want to pass judgment on the idea of splicing it out into two different episodes until we see what happens in the second episode. Because my concern here is that the winner's curse might happen. Is someone who has the idea of the restaurant, the concept of the restaurant, might actually have more responsibility in the second episode. And therefore, if they screw up even a little bit, it's going to fall on them because it was their quote-unquote restaurant. Whereas in past seasons, it's kind of a group effort, right? It's kind of a all hands on deck. Let's come up with our idea, our themes, our menu. Whereas this time around, I feel like Gregory and Kevin are going to just have a little bit more on their plate, so to speak.
I do want to tease that we are going to have shortly, stay tuned. Do you say stay tuned on a podcast? Stay tuned. Chef Eric Agjapon is going to be with us.
Yes!
Shortly.
Yes!
We're going to get through kind of the headlines, and then we're going to bring in Chef Eric. Thrilled about this. But Tom, my primary misgiving is a little bit different. I'm not sure I like it, and this is the reason. One of the great tension points of Restaurant Wars is the battle over vision. the battle over who is going to serve as executive chef, what the restaurant's going to look like. You know, but there's a lot of ego involved. That first 15 minutes where they're sitting there with a notepad and this one is typing in and this person sort of taking the back seat, maybe even by strategy. I like that. I'll reserve full judgment, but I like that tension that comes out of starting from scratch. Who takes charge? And I'm with you in this sense. I mean, I suppose there's something affirming about having your restaurant selected. But as you have pointed out, Tom, and I'm sure you might have the stats, if not at your fingertips, you can summarize them for us. It is understood that you will go home. That the only people who generally go home, with a few exceptions, I don't know how many exceptions there are the executive chef at Restaurant Wars or front of the house.
Right.
So by, quote, rewarding Gregory and Kevin, and that's great. Hey, they get the bragging rights for a week. Congratulations. You just increased the possibility of elimination by like 60% next week. Here's your prize for your winning pitch.
I'm with you. I hadn't considered that, the idea that right now we kind of lose that scramble, the ego check of, hey, you're front of house, you're the executive chef, you're the sous chef. Like that is a fundamental element and a huge draw of Restaurant Wars, is that awkwardness and just seeing who's the alpha, seeing who's going to feel like they've been cornered out of the conversation. Now, we might still get a little of that in the next episode, Kevin, but I do agree that this curveball, just like they did last year, where an early, or 2 years ago was the early, was it last year? Was it last year when we went to,
It was last season. Yeah, it was last season.
Last season. The last season when they did an early Restaurant Wars, this year, because maybe there's a lot more, I don't know, veterans on this staff, they wanted to kind of kick it up a notch and have all of them pitch their restaurants, which I get it, because there's Top Chef Masters people on this show. There's, shit, we got Brian Malarkey, who's opened approximately, I wrote it down, 305 restaurants in the past 6 months. So we've got some people who have a lot of experience down this way. So maybe the whole idea of like a communal brain trust of building a restaurant together might not have been as smooth. But maybe that is kind of the draw, is that we want some of that adversity, want some of that conflict. So we do get Restaurant Wars a little bit early, but I will say, Kevin, you can do whatever you want, but only three people have won an episode this season. It's been Kevin, Gregory, and Melissa. Everyone else has been in the middle or the bottom this season. There have been only three winners, and I'm pretty sure that this has never happened through seven episodes in Top Chef.
Right. There have been nine winners. Each has three. And that is, we talked about the tiers a couple of weeks ago. They've become even more pronounced. There are three chefs who are decidedly better. I want to talk about a fourth chef, and we did it a little bit last week. You know, in some respects, Brian Veltaggio is not underperforming. We picked him fifth in the draft. He is currently fourth in our scoring system. And yet somehow he feels like a disappointment. And I think there's just something a little ominous that he seems to, and again, I mentioned that he doesn't get the sweet spot of any challenge. He's cooking well, but it's always a little off center relative to what the assignment is. Yet it's not, you know, it's funny. Generally, when we talk about a chef who's coloring outside the lines, it's because, oh, they need some editing. No, he's as structured and as precise as always. It's just, he's not, it's like a great writer who hears the assignment and he turns in and files something really good, but this is not what we ask for. Mm. And so I think, but Veltaggio is an interesting, I think he's emerged by virtue of his, well, whether it's underperformance or just performance, one of the more interesting chefs in this competition.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think his taco dish was evidence of what his problem is. Is he's going over the top fancy, formal. And I think that is like fine dining Brian Veltaggio, just going a little too far and not focusing more of his energy on doing the challenge and focusing on the spirit of the challenge. So he did a filet of salmon taco with salmon roe on top of it. Now, Kevin, I love me some salmon. I love me some salmon roe. I love me some taco. But all three, it doesn't really work because I think he overthinks or tries to make it an elevated dish times a multiplier of 10. And I think for Voltaggio, that energy he's focusing on in terms of elevating a concept needs to be muted a little bit and just focusing on, okay, how do I make the best dish for this this challenge?
Right. I mean, work to a challenge is strengths. And the strength of this challenge was, I mean, tacos are really savory. There's nothing elegant about them. There are some elevated street tacos. I mean, you know, one of my favorite places here in town is Guisado's. You know, you get a little, a fun mole or a fun crema on top. But at the end of the day, it's still savory meat.
Yeah.
That is grilled, right? I mean, and I loved, you know, it's funny, Kevin didn't place in the challenge, but I love the al pastor. You know, mix it up with a little banana rather than the pineapple that accompanies al pastor. We'll go quickly this because I don't want to bog down. I'd love just to kind of talk with Eric, so I don't want to spend too much time there with him on the. So let's do the quick fire now. You know, Leanne, Karen, and Stephanie play. Stephanie, good for her that she got immunity, and boy did she need it. But she came out with lambs, cucumbers, did her own fresh masa corn tortilla, and she buys herself a week. And what's funny about Stephanie is, Tom, she ain't going to go home next week. You know why? She's going to be a line cook. And it's funny because I'm not trying to drag Stephanie. She's my contestant. I've been very favorable on her. I think she has serious limitations that are going to prevent her from making it all the way to the final four. But next week's going to be interesting because who's going to be on the chopping block? It's going to be front of the house and it's going to be executive chef. Tom, I would bet my house on the fact that no line chef is going home because no line chef ever goes home on restaurants.
What if she volunteers to be front of house?
I think we saw in the preview, it looks like Malarkey, who, by the way, perfect. Yeah. He ain't going home either because, like, that guy's going to be great in the front of the house. Like, he's Mr. Front of the House. He reminds me of Uncle Saul. So I grew up, as I've mentioned on this show, my aunts and uncles had the definitive Jewish deli in Atlanta for the better part of 60 years. And it was my Uncle Dave just slaving behind the counter. I mean, that guy was cutting pastrami. He was cutting corned beef. I mean, Dave was just – He was logging innings, and my Aunt Renee was on the cash register, and my Aunt Fran was sort of kind of expediting and kind of just keeping she was the glue man. And what was Uncle Saul doing? Just glad handing with all the folks from Buckhead, just like schmoozing it up at the front of the house while Dave was back there schwitzing. And that's going to be Malarkey next week. I'm not going to project because we'll have plenty to talk about next week, but I think we see Karen at the front of the house. She runs the restaurant, and it looks like obviously we know who our exec chefs will be. So it'll be very interesting kind of how sort of the line chefs just skate by. And, you know, Stephanie's going to be in the final seven, even though she has, you know, serious difficulties. One last point before we go to Eric. My Eric Schwartzel brought up a really good point just about Top Chef and reality competition shows in general. Which is we're starting to see the Shark Tankization of reality TV.
Yes. I have this in my notes. It's a great, great point.
You know, he was watching a show that I wasn't familiar with called Making the Cut, which is essentially Top Chef for dress designers. Really well thought of show. I think if you are a reality competition person, it's just I don't have room in my life for more than one. And sure enough, what Eric was explaining was it's all about, which contestant's going to have the line that you'll sell on Amazon, right? And we've already seen in this season of Top Chef, hey, what product are you going to make for the masses that can go on a shelf and sell like gangbusters?
Right now, it's only a notion, but I think I can get money to make it into a concept and then later turn it into an idea.
Restaurant Wars this year is not just a creative endeavor. It's, hey, pitch us. And by and large, I mean, the chefs were judged in many respects on the quality of their pitch. So it is it's all about the business now. Not all, but increasingly relative to the early seasons of Top Chef, and we're seeing it across reality TV. It's the influence of Shark Tank, entrepreneurship entering the competition in a way that it hadn't previously.
I think it might be because of just branding in general. Is like you have to come up with a brand. You have to sell your brand. And I think that it's honing down on that idea, is that the brandification of just everything in culture, pop culture now. So I think it speaks to like distill down your brand, what your identity comes from, and pitch it. And I think that's where this episode went to. And I think we actually had it a couple of weeks ago too, with the loved one episode, is that they had to do a Shark Tank again.
And it's just, it's so we've had, you know, essentially 7 weeks, I believe, and you know, 28.6% of them, you know, essentially, hey, what's your business look like?
Yes.
And again, I don't know that I have a problem with it. It's just an interesting feature to the show. And again, I think you're right. Like, this is the culture, right? You're a brand. I mean, we see it in the NBA all the time. I mean, these guys are brand obsessed. And you know what? All power to them. You know, you've got your, you know, that is the game. You're no longer just a craftsman. You are a full-fledged brand and a full-fledged business.
So on that note, let's bring on Chef Eric onto the show. And just for people who don't know, we've had him on the show before, and he is just awesome. Big NBA fan, so we'll probably hit that a little bit. But mostly, so much we want to get in with Eric here. And man, what an episode. We haven't even talked about it, but man, I can't wait to talk to Eric about what happened and just the whole season in general. So,
yeah. And by the way, thank you, Eric, for being a good sport. I suspect it's a little humbling coming on the week you get eliminated. And I just want to thank Eric in advance for, I just think it's super cool that, hey, I'll come on, even though it was arguably my worst week in my Top Chef career.
Geez, my feet haven't touched pavement since I reached Los Angeles.
Well, will you take a meeting with me? I'll take a meeting with you if you'll take a meeting with Freddie.
I took a meeting with Freddie. Freddie took a meeting with Charlie. You take a meeting with him.
All the good meetings are taken.
Yeah, we're joined right now by Chef Eric. This is, and I was just saying to the audience, thank you for being a good sport. I imagine, you know, coming on the week you're eliminated, you know, I was hoping you'd be able to come on, take a victory lap. But so thank you for, I mean, just what a classy thing. And so thank you for subjecting yourself to us.
It's easy, guys. No, you guys are a lot of fun to talk to. So whether it be a week that I just got eliminated or one that won, I'm always happy to talk to you guys. How are you guys doing?
We're good. We're great.
Good.
We just did like a 15-minute recap of the episode, just big themes, but it's a whole big chunk of this episode and this season that is Eric Agyapong. So we can't wait to talk to you. And I just remember Michael Jordan had to talk after losing to the Pistons for 3 seasons in a row. So guess what? Eric Agyapong here at the podium. You are our Michael Jordan. So thank you for We had scheduled this for the listeners.
That's right.
We had scheduled this a couple weeks ago, and Kevin and I and Eric are on a text chain, and we're shooting the shit about the NBA and Top Chef, whatever it is. And I just said, hey, Restaurant Wars, I want you on the show. And you were like, let's do it. I'm game. You have a good poker face, man, because you didn't let us in on any of what just happened.
I couldn't have, man. I think they have a pretty high bounty on our heads if we let out any information. So I try to keep things lock and key. But no, man, I knew exactly what was going to happen this week, obviously. But either way, man, again, it's just always good to talk to you guys. So I had to keep a straight face as much as possible.
Yeah. Was it a good season for you? I mean, notwithstanding the earlier elimination than you wanted. It's such an interesting, I mean, God, there's a lot of talent on that show this year. I mean, it's crazy.
It was a good season, man. You have no idea. The talent pool was just insane. Obviously, this is the second time, the group, the franchise is doing an all-star season. So they didn't want to pull any punches with this one. So man, I just said, like, out of all the 14 other chefs that I competed against, like, anybody could have had an easy path to winning the entire thing. So, I mean, the competition was steep. The challenges were even insane too, man. The amount of volume we were doing so early. And then I think the third thing was really impressive to me was just the caliber of chefs that they had to judge.
Oh yeah.
I mean, as early as week one and two.
Like on the beach, it was a 92 dream team.
Exactly that, man. So it was, there's really not a lot of wool you can pull over the judge's eyes or anybody's eyes, honestly. And I think Every little mistake, big or small, is really something to talk about and could quite possibly put you on the bottom.
It was not all for lost, all for naught, because you had seven episodes on the show and you might have been knocked out just before the full-blown restaurant wars. But, Eric, in a couple episodes ago, you were able to cook with your wife, Janelle. And
that's right.
Not only that, like of all the things that you could do on Top Chef, that's got to be right there at the top. But secondly, this was the seed of your new restaurant, right? Like this, your new restaurant
exactly.
In D.C., A, you get to cook with your wife, which has got to be a top five moment of your life. And B, you got the germination of this new food concept that is going to be opening. So, man, that's got to feel good in the end.
Yeah, man, absolutely. And that's a good call. I mean, I had in mind to do the concept for some time. And when the opportunity kind of presented itself by, I knew that if I could make the double to dish, I'd would. So when, you know, we were kind of pitching a product and I was like, you know, this would be a perfect opportunity to do so. And I'm really glad I did it. And it was so crazy that my wife was with me the entire time. I mean, it felt oddly familiar, but extremely weird at the same time. And as intense as you can imagine, I mean, still have cameras and still like challenge mode. It's still go, go, go. But to have my wife and kind of have that sense of calm right next to me, I think definitely helped out for sure. But yeah, the doubles dish, it did well and really gave me the battery behind my back to let me know like, hey, I can really make this fly and really, you know, this has some legs behind it.
Yeah. One thing I was noting that week is it looks beautiful in the bottle. Like it's just, it is,
man, thank you.
You know, it's like there are certain foods or sauces or condiments you just gravitate to because, I mean, they're gorgeous. Like food is ultimately an aesthetic object.
Sure.
And your stuff looks great. And it's just, yeah, and by the way, it was fun to see that because I do think one of the judges, I think it was Gail, said that was a week you were in your happy place. And one of the things I think with you is not just your wife being there, but I think you are great at a singular bite. Like I was going back to that oyster season, like that drumlet at Rupp Arena, the fufu plantain dumpling, you know, you are the, like you are Mr. Bite. It's just like that singular thing where you bring in just, you know, zest and personal expression, like the stuff you love doing. And I just love seeing you in that context.
Man, that's a really good call, Kev. I think you're absolutely right with that. Like I really relished in those challenges where it was just like, hey, put as much flavor, really tell a story, let it be concise, but also let it just be like impactful, flavorful, and really gets to you. So I did well with those, and the ones in between, I either got in the middle or I ended up on the bottom. But it was an all around just fun experience. Even both seasons, man, it's kind of crazy because I look at both seasons now together, even though they're, you know, two separate, clearly separate things happened. It's just all kind of muddled in together now for me. But it's a good call, man. You're absolutely right with that.
I want to just start with this episode here. We did a quick recap at the top. You seemed exhausted.
Jeez.
You seemed like it seemed like you pulled an all-nighter for like three days in going into this one.
Absolutely.
So paint us the picture. What was going on this episode? The machete quickfire and then the make your pitch to the crew.
So for a lot of folks that don't know, like the behind the scenes with Top Chef, it's shot congruently. So there's not like a week in between, just kind of like how you view it. So I just remember the past challenges, like the double elimination. I think it was Karen and Nini that had gone up against Brian and I. And generally, I was tired. Like I just ran out of gas, man. I really did. And it's not an entire excuse because everyone is tired at this point. Everyone's just like physically, mentally exhausted. They try to give us days in between to kind of catch up, but you're still working in between.
How late was that double elimination episode was? Because I think Karen had mentioned that while you guys were cooking, she was while you guys were sleeping after that double elimination, she was still in Last Chance Kitchen.
She was still going. Yeah, absolutely. And that right there is probably one of the most impressive feats. It probably won't get caught over by the season's end. But like, as far as like individual feats throughout the entire season from any cast member, what Karen did in that like 24, even less than 24 hour span was insane. To do the double elimination, fight your way back through Last Chance Kitchen, to make yourself, bring yourself back onto the competition in and of itself is like a beast. So when I saw her come back, I was one, not surprised because she's an amazing chef, but just like really impressed by like, dude, like you, that was the gauntlet right there. And I just going through what I was feeling, it was intense. I mean, so the mood board situation, that took way too much time for me. I was probably the last person to go to sleep. It was me and Greg, I remember, talking it over. And I might've gotten all but like an hour and a half of rest that night, just focused on the mood board, really just trying to put those pieces together. And then just thinking in retrospect, that clearly was the Achilles heel throughout the day. Like it bled into the cook, it bled into the pitch, it bled into literally everything the entire day, the quick fire. I mean, everyone is tired, but it really, really like that. I was running on E, man, and it showed for sure.
You know, we love anytime we can fit in a basketball metaphor. And one of the things you said at the judges' table was, you know, I wasn't in rhythm. And it immediately spoke to me just because you see on like good weeks where, or hell, I mean, even when you're at home, like that beautiful thing on a cook where just as one task is done, mm-hmm. like it's the perfect timing. Oh, good. That's great because now I need to move to this task right at this moment. And like that ultimately is cooking is a rhythmic task.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Well said. I mean, and it goes back into just even like you mentioned, in any sort of basketball reference, when you see a shooter hot for 3 or 4 days, there's clearly a zone that they're in. There's clearly a rhythm that they're in. And same thing with Top Chef, like everyone for, you know, wherever they're at individually is kind of picking up the rhythm, whether they're in it, they're feeling it, or they might just be on the tail end of it, to be honest. So I myself, man, I just was trying to find something to keep me going. I mean, the challenges themselves are pretty intense. So if that's not firing you up, then I'm not sure what is. And it did. I was ready to go. My concept was in mind. I felt strong about it. But it just was not just clicking the entire day, man. And to be honest, man, those are the little things that kind of eliminate chefs every season. I feel like if we have a cast of 15 people, let's just say for 16, 17 seasons, two or three of those people in each season are going to get kicked off because of those mental errors, those mental lapses, that, you know, not being in rhythm. And that just kind of happens. And I think I really fell into that whole mix.
Yeah, I was thinking like the margins on this season are crazy.
Oh, my goodness. Tom, yeah.
Like if you nail that duck, you ain't going home.
No. I mean, there's confidence in that. I mean, I had two dishes too, and that was probably another thing that there was not a lot of self-editing when I realized like I'm behind the clock. My prep is not anywhere where I want it to be. I had the option to continue to do like either both dishes or one, and just locked into just stupidity, I guess, at this point. But I just really was committed to really showcasing two dishes. And, you know, editing yourself is huge. It's a huge kind of a plus that you can do or have when you're on the competition. It's just like, you know, pause, try to regroup, try to figure out where you're at and how you can probably make this situation the best that it, you know, it could be.
Was there any funny machete stories that we didn't get to see?
Probably in the beginning. You know what? There was before it was actually revealed, there was a box covering everything. And I remember there was like Padma was there and she was like trying to tug on the string.
Oh, yeah. It was like a contraption.
A little contraption thing. And that took a while. That took a few takes, I remember. So we were like, the chef's side, we were all kind of like, what the hell is going on? We were anticipating something. And then like every three pulls, it just wouldn't come down. So after like 30 minutes or so, 20 minutes on our side that you clearly didn't see on TV, we found out that we're cooking with machetes. And it's like, all right, great.
Have you ever worked with a machete before?
Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like,
whatever. Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep. Free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
I have, man, I have, but not to that degree. It's not the same when you're, you know, trying to cut bush or you're trying to, like, you know, make a trail or something like that, versus trying to, like, finesse a mango and trying to brunoise some shallots or whatever. That's just completely two different skill sets, man. So I definitely am comfortable with one, but I think everyone got caught off guard just trying to make that machete work.
Eric, I just want to ask, where are your box out skills? What's going on here? Because in the quick fires, it feels like people are beating you to the punch, and you're a big time athlete. I know that you know how to box people out. And in this machete episode, the same deal is, I feel like you're one of the last few people to get your utensil, you get your product. So what's happening here? We need to get you in a room with Charles Barkley.
You know, clearly Ben Wallace or Rodman, neither. it's funny, man. Like I always keep in mind not to look like an idiot on TV, because I, for whatever reason, I have in mind, this is going to air eventually, and I'm not trying to push any old ladies out the way or step on any toes either way.
It's cutthroat. I mean, this is Top Chef, baby.
It is, man. It is. And I to be honest, man, I'm like, if it's for me, it's for me. If it's not, then I'll move on to the next and try to make it as delicious as possible. So that was my whole mindset, man. Not just like to stomp on anybody, not to, because I am a pretty big dude. And can you imagine, like, on the reverse, like, man, Eric really, you know, just dunked on her while trying to get some some product or whatever. Yeah.
Among the chefs who, like, you talk about that rhythm, you talk about just you look over at the station and it is the Terminator. Like, is a robot. Who is the most, like, robot impressive, like, it just effortless in terms of prep? I'm not talking about the final product. I'm just talking about process.
Man, watching Melissa work was pretty, like, it was beautiful, man. She's a swan. Like, she really is, like, there's no wasted efforts. I think that's probably the most impressive thing. Like, she goes to one direction of the kitchen, and you're not going to see her there again because she got everything that she needed, and she's back there. And that like, those little bits of, like, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, maybe 10-second pops saves you a bunch of time when it just comes to, like, plating and getting down to your dish and focusing. So it was really impressive to watch her to watch her prep. I really enjoyed watching Stephanie as well. She was, it's cool to watch her kind of think through her dish as she's cooking it. So she's either, like, talking herself into something completely amazing or talking herself out of something as well. So it was awesome, watching her cook. Ah, man.
You said you were late at night with Gregory. Were you guys close on this show?
For sure. Greg was an awesome, sounding board for me, and, it was cool because I admired him for some time, before the entire show started. We never really, like, we, you know, Instagram friends or whatever. But it wasn't anything, like, serious. And by the time I started speaking to him when the competition started, it was kind of like when you speak to someone and you know them for a while. It was pretty cool. So Greg was awesome. He was a great sounding board, and same thing for me. Like, he threw ideas at me, and, you know, we edited each other as much as possible. So he was really cool, man. He's an awesome chef. And he's another person who's really, really great to watch as well cook.
Yeah. It's like, I always say he's like error free ball, you know, like yeah. He's like the Spurs of, you know, the 15 Spurs.
Not
Spurs.
A lot, like, of turnovers. Yeah, for
right.
sure.
Like it's just like, and it's never too complicated and never too simple. Like it's yep. sweet spot every time.
Absolutely.
Hey, Eric, when did you find out you were going to be a part of the show? And, can you walk us through the thought process on coming back to Top Chef?
It was like a week after the season. No. it was some time after, man. It was probably like I would say 4 to 5 months. Once season 16 was over, they reached out. And I kind of had an idea that was, you know, floating amongst the Top Chef alum that they were thinking about doing an all-star season. So getting that call again, I kind of expected it. And, you know, they asked me, took about a week to think about it. And it was a week that it was just mostly me thinking, but my wife was like, no, go for it, do it. And I made it happen. So it was cool, man. I think if I can remember, we were in New York, just doing like the pre-casting spiel and all that stuff, and got to see some other contestants that could possibly not be on. So kind of gauging the competition as, you know, before anything really started. And then we flew out to LA, and that was that, man. Like that first episode when we were in front of Gail and Tom, and we were, the segmenting oranges and artichokes, mm-hmm. and the almonds. That was literally the first time we saw everyone up front, and it was like, oh, okay, cool. This is who I'm up against.
Oh, so you didn't know who you were going against?
Nah, not at all, man. I had Nini. I knew Nini was going to be on. And I heard rumblings of other people. I heard rumblings of Brian Voltaggio. I heard rumblings of Leanne.
The rumblings.
But the rumblings, man. Yeah. They. Other than that, man, it was pretty much just all surprise once we got there.
It's funny. It's like there's not a lot of conflict. I mean, Malarkey plays a character and there's good shtick there, but I kind of get the sense that everybody's sort of like, he knows it's shtick. It's sort of part of the,
And
like that, he's totally. Almost kind of lovably eccentric, and
he's the greatest showman. He's the greatest showman. Yeah. Malarkey is, he definitely puts his best foot forward, but you're right, man. There was not a lot of conflict in there. At this point in our careers, though, you got to imagine, like, everyone's been, you know, 10 plus years, 20 plus years in the game. We know what we want out of this. This is our either second or third time around for, you know, competing on Top Chef. So there really wasn't much that anyone felt like they could pull that anyone else didn't really expect or knew, or, you know what I mean? So it was really just focusing on the competition and really doing your best. So the integrity was high, and I love that. It's a great atmosphere to cook in as well.
I actually kind of feel like there wasn't much. I mean, for all of the talent on the show, there weren't huge egos. Like when you talk about Gregory, he was trying to collaborate with Nini and Stephanie and you.
Right. Yep.
There weren't a lot of huge personalities who were like, fuck y'all, I'm going to do my stuff. And it seemed like, yes, you had really big, successful, big name chefs, But they seem to be team players, like Voltaggio, Melissa. Right. It seemed like people got along. And I know people at home might want to feel like, hey, this should be a soap opera. We want that conflict. We want the reality TV show at each other's necks. But I think they did an incredible job of casting this season in terms of people who are willing to work together, because on the first five episodes, it's a lot of team play.
Yeah, good call. It is. And you learn quickly about yourself, and it's an ego kind of, like you mentioned, you're obviously you want to impart and put as much of your flavor and spin on whatever dish that you're doing as a team. But then you really think about, like, this is a team project, and they're really looking for an inclusiveness from everyone. So you can't necessarily be too loud, or you can't have too much of a say, because that's a criteria that they're looking for specifically. And again, we've all been through this this gauntlet of Top Chef, and we know how team challenges versus solo challenges work. So if you're not including that team aspect and really trying to get everybody in sync, they'll call you out for it. And, you know, I think one episode was the vegetarian, where we had to do the tasting menu. And that was it right there. Like, you can see the other team, they didn't really collaborate as well as far as collaborating on the cohesiveness and kind of like the progression of the menu. So those are the little things. And I'm pretty sure just single bites, if everyone was to serve that dish, you know, as their own, it would have been an incredible kind of, you know, progression in the menu. But they were specifically looking for that one voice, that one sound, and they called them out for it.
Yeah, it's funny. I think it speaks to the enduring quality of the show, because, like, I was an early Survivor fan, and you watched it for the conflict. And this show has gotten so good at what it does. The competitions in and of themselves are so interesting. Like, you don't feel deprived because people aren't motherfucking each other. And I think, correct, like, I think it speaks to the quality. Like they've gotten really good at producing this show. Like, even relative to, like, you know, middle seasons, like, they are just a well-oiled machine.
Yeah. Magical Elves, they don't play any games, man. They're a professional group, and they know exactly what they want. I think what's most impressive, another thing, is not only just the chefs, but watching them work behind the cameras, the audio team, the visual team, they're just kind of directing everything, the producers. Like, it's a true production. And like you said, they don't really hold back, and they put out a great product. And it's no surprise that you know, they're nominated every single year for this Emmy. Like, it's a true competition show. They want to see the best out of the chefs, and they really want us to put, you know, the best dishes that we can out there. So they give us all the tools, at least they try to, for us to succeed in that effort, man. And it's cool. It really shows.
You know, it's interesting. I love this idea of conveying historical narrative through a meal. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, every chef has a point of view, and it's almost a cliche of cooking. Every chef, you know, to some extent tells a story. But I love the fact that, I mean, the fact is, that's not necessarily your story. I mean, you're kind of, your desire is to elevate that even further, that you're going to tell an all-encompassing historical narrative. I think it's so interesting.
Yeah, I think so too, man. And thank you. It's one of those things where it's a mix of just my culture, my heritage, where I grew up from. And then also the things that I've captured along the way as far as knowledge and understanding how the diaspora works and what foods we're eating. And essentially everything is the same. So I figured, I mean, why not? It's an important story. It's a part of the American fabric. It's a part of the world fabric. And it's there's so much delicious food that comes from this area, and this story specifically. So it was one that, man, obviously, like you said, in season 16, I was really excited to showcase some of those things and some of those dishes, and then having the opportunity to go ahead and do it again this season was really exciting for me, you know. And I'm definitely continuing on and editing and polishing that concept up along the way. So once we can kind of get back to normalcy and everything kind of dies down with the virus, man, I'm really hoping to hit that full steam ahead.
You know, you and I were texting last year about this. I think there's like a total, like, genre busting cookbook here. Like, do you know Herman Bennett? Do you know Herman Bennett at CUNY, at City University of New York?
All right, no.
His literal title is scholar of the African diaspora.
That's awesome.
Like, he's in New York. And, like, that's awesome. I just think, like, you guys should team up, like, something that's, like, part history book. I mean, true history.
Like,
a narrative through. Like, I just think this is an – I mean, of course, it's my idea, so it's awesome. I just think this is a really – like, you're the guy to do it. And like, team up. Like that guy – I mean, I think he got his doctorate at Duke. I mean, he's just like – again, I mean, the guy is literally the scholar of the African diaspora. And y'all should do it.
Man, that sounds amazing. And I'd love to take him up on that offer if he's available to do so. Because you're right, man. It's not just – like a spoken narrative. It really is something that comes alive, and it adds another dimension to experience when you can actually eat the food. And I don't think it's an avenue that's been explored as much. We've seen movies, we've seen that, you know, we've heard the stories, and, you know, we celebrate, you know, different pioneers, you know, from the era, but the food isn't really, you know, celebrated or known. And I think that's something that it has so many notches to really go in and dive in. I think I view that on a menu, and, you know, how well we can change up the seasons and the food and the offerings and things like that. So pairing it up with history and really telling the story that's one, authentic, but two, delicious, is like, that's man, that's a no brainer for me.
Like, you know, it's funny. I remember, look, I grew up in the South. And so, you know, driving to my grandparents' house in Charleston, I mean, you're passing plantations.
That's right.
But it's kind of, the truth is like, it wasn't until I went to Cape Coast in Ghana, where, and you look at what they call like slave castles, which is just, I mean, haunting and
right.
Kind of a ridiculous term. I mean, I don't even under, but just the idea of, rather than using destination, using origin, because it's just something I think, look, I grew up in Atlanta. You're steeped in that history as it begins in the 18th century or 17th century, but you don't go further back. I mean, and I there was always something a little unsatisfying. And I just think, like, going back through culinary experience, like going back to Cape Coast is just,
you know, totally. That's a really great point. I mean, and it's another way to, even for folks who don't come from Atlanta and, you know, grew up in the South, to really get a great true immersion of what the culture is, what the food is, what the people are about, and what these stories, you know, can tell. So food is a great kind of olive branch, so to speak. And it's a great communal tool to bring people together, have conversations, and really, like, push that narrative forward. So that's essentially what I was trying to do. That's what I'm planning to do with the restaurant, and I'm excited for it. I think since then I've been able to edit the menu, edit the kind of focus that I really want to have. So I'm excited to let that news out whenever it's ready. But man, I love the fact to hear that from you, Kev, because that's essentially what I'm trying to do.
Wait. The news of what?
So I have in mind to open this restaurant, man. It really is going to happen. And that's the thing that's bubbling up right now. I mean, obviously I want to double as a focus. But once this is all said and done, man, I'm really looking forward to opening up this restaurant and really telling those stories, and presenting all that food and the style of service as well, is what I'm really excited about as well.
But is it white glove or is it casual?
That right there was, that was hilarious for me, but it's a little bit of both, man. I really stand behind that because, and one thing I probably didn't do is just the best job of explaining it, but I really want the service to feel as if you're coming back to your grandma's house, the service to feel like if you're coming back home. But you're eating some really refined plates. And I think I've been to, you know, a few restaurants here in DC that kind of offer a very similar feel, whether it be like a Rose's Luxury, you know, Tail of Goat, spaces that you feel really comfortable in.
I love that place.
Yeah, but that they still serve you a great plate of food, or plates of food. So that's definitely the focus to have in mind, man, and not to be so white gloved and stuffy. So definitely a food.
When I'm watching you up on the, doing the pitch to the judges, you could sense that you were stressed just from trying to finish your dish, and it looked like Voltaggio, jumping in and helping you. Were there others that helped you try to finish plating?
Leanne was right next to me. Yeah, she was right next to me, and she stopped what she was doing because she knew that I was up. So it's what they didn't capture was that it was like a staggered kind of cook. So I came in first round.
Yeah.
I came in first round. It was Greg and I that started cooking. So by the time, at least the way the production set it up, by the time that I was ready to go up and present to the judges, another round of chefs would have started coming in and starts, you know, their prep and their mise en place or whatever. So Leanne, she was just coming in to, you know, to start her dish. So she saw that I was essentially just down in the weeds and racing to get back into a good timing and space to at least, you know, present to the judges. So she helped me out. Brian was there to help out as well. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I was, man, frantic as hell just going up there. And that was not the space that I wanted to be in. And it's kind of funny because, like, you know, when you're when you got a bad grade and you have to send that report card and you're just kind of dreading it. That's essentially what it was. Like, I knew the cook was bad, and that bled into the pitch and essentially just, you know, ended chopping me and going home.
There was a lot of this season. One of the themes I kind of got was in every episode, it seemed you could see the judges as they're eating your food. And it mm-hmm. seemed like more so than in years past. You were in the kitchen able to kind of eavesdrop on
True.
The judges. Was that part of what made this season even more stressful is not only are you going against the juggernauts, but you're also able to struggling, I'm guessing, to block out the noise and not focus too much on what the judges' table is saying as they're eating your dish.
Man, and you know, it's funny, a lot of the noise is coming from yourself as well, especially when, like, perfect example, when I got eliminated, you know, I'm presenting food that I wasn't even, you know, I'm 100% sure that this is going to be the most delicious plate of food that I served. So as I'm trying to pitch and that's going through my head. It's just like, dude, it's crazy because you're watching their expressions while they're eating and asking you questions. And it's a painstaking kind of process.
Imagine
watching
the teacher grading your paper. I would hate that.
When you know you failed, like, you know, that's the thing. Like, you know, you did a bad job. You know, you got under 60% or whatever the case is, 50%. And you're just kind of waiting for that final, you know, that final mark. But you kind of have the answer before, you know, she gives you anything official. And that's literally what I felt like going up there. Like, I just knew my cook was bad. And clearly just kind of just tore through everything else. So
I really felt that when you were up there at the judges table and you're facing the music, I really felt that I wrote this down is that there are two ways you can go at the judges table, one owning it or two just being surprised. Wow.
I
thought this was a great dish. Maybe you got a bad bite and trying to pump up your dish by saying the judges were wrong in some sense. You didn't do that. You just completely owned it.
Or number three, like the old school Jen Carroll, which is you people are fucking idiots. that's the third question.
I definitely took the former. I couldn't like, I mean, I knew what the deal was. And it was crazy because when they called, it was Stephanie, Leanne, and myself. Stephanie had immunity.
Yes.
So it was really just a 50% toss at that point. And once it kind of happened, I didn't even know, to be honest, how Leanne's cook went. When the judges deliberated with her, it didn't sound as bad as what they did for me. And that was just kind of like the tip, you know, for me. And I was just like, yeah, this is it for me. So, it's a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah. What's the Last Chance Kitchen, experience? Like, I've come to love that segment. Like, I like it just as much as the show now.
And to rewind a little bit, Eric, just so you don't feel like you're divulging too much information, we know that, like, they line them up, boom, 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 boom. So it's not week to week to week. So this one was different, though, because you're starting from a new segment of the Last Chance Kitchen. So
exactly,
the timing of it, can you give us some insight on the timing of it and what you knew going into Last Chance Kitchen?
Exactly. So my round, or when I got eliminated, like you mentioned, the Last Chance Kitchen kind of circuit started all over again. So it was Nini, that was the first challenger. And to be honest, man, the entire kind of set is just, it's a completely different, cast of producers, or, it's a just different kind of group that's handling it. And it's really Tom's domain. Like, you see Tom light up. This is where he shines because it's so crazy, man. Like, he's stoic. He tries to keep to himself. He might crack a joke or two during, like, the actual competition. But when it comes to, like, you know, Last Chance, he's alive, man. And it's so cool to see him kind of get in his element. So
is
that
it
was
cool
it.
And because he was grilling you, man. Like he was the rhubarb. I was just cringing. I was like, oh, Tom is going in. And he went in on Nene too.
He did. I mean, again, that's where he likes to, that's really where he likes to cut his teeth, man. Like that's his space right there. So, you understand going in, that's the domain. But to be honest, that was my first time in Last Chance Kitchen. I've never experienced it before. So I just went in to try to have as much fun as possible. And it's hard to not have fun when you're around Needy too. So I trying to get back into it, but I was also like, you know what, man, let's just cook the best plate of food I can. Crack some jokes in between.
Nene's funny because, like, as Tom knows, I stand for Nene like every week. I'm still convinced she's the best chef who, like, has gotten eliminated early twice. Like, I actually
Say so. Yeah. Yep. I would definitely say so. I mean, Nene has the matzo ball soup was one of the most, like, ingenious things I've ever seen anybody do or create on the show. And watching her do that and just how eclectic her brain is. And it comes to food, man, she's a joy to watch and be around. So yeah, it was a no brainer to have. I mean, it's hard not to have a good time around Nene. She's truly one of the best chefs. And like you said, to get eliminated, as early as she has, like if there was ever a season of Top Chef, All-Stars, to get eliminated, like seriously right before they were, you know, about to peak, I think, Nene would be the first build of cast for sure.
What is on the list of cuisines? Where does Italian food rank on your most favorite go-to things to cook?
I would say
top half, bottom half.
Yeah, I would say top half. Easy. Top half. I just made some fried diavolo sauce with some scallops and shrimp and linguine like 2 nights ago. So I'm always in the bag as far as cooking Italian food. I just love the simplicity. I'm a huge, you know, fan of just simple ingredients, really speaking out for the entire dish. And I think that's what Italian food does really well. So it was caught off guard with the Last Chance Kitchen. And that's another thing too, man, like there's zero room for any sort of conceptualization. I think that's where I work best. If I have 30 minutes to an hour just to kind of think about what it is that I want to do. I've noticed that at least I've rendered myself a little bit better than I have, if not, you know what I mean? So it's when you're in Last Chance Kitchen, it's just go, go, go. And you're just really cooking off the hip. So it was tough, man.
What is quarantine cooking like for you? I mean, you know, there are a lot of us who it's kind of an opportunity, but it's also hard to get exactly what you need and you can't just run out to the grocery. Like, I mean, how's it been for you?
It's been good, you know, just catching up with things that I haven't touched on in some time back in like culinary school. So a lot of baking is happening. It's the year of the yeast. And I've been baking like crazy. I just baked some cinnamon rolls. So doing a lot of baking, but when it comes to just like dishes that I can sustain for some time, 2 to 3 days is definitely what my focus is. Like you mentioned, can't really go to the grocery store as often as I want to. Instacart has been like backed up for weeks now. So there's no delivery happening either. So really it's just trying to utilize and stretch the food out as much as possible. So luckily in my house, we're all, you know, non-picky eaters and we'll eat for pretty much anything at the most part. So it's easy to feed my family. My 2-year-old's or my almost 2-year-old is she's probably the pickiest out of all of us, but she still does really well.
What is the viewing situation like for you versus last season?
That one is completely different. It's a lot of virtual. Like my family has a group chat. We have a group chat as Top Chef alum from season 17. So it's been cool just kind of catching up, popping in and out with Twitter, almost like the Grammys or the Oscars or like a live sporting event. It's really just a lot of, you know, on one platform for like 30 seconds and then hopping on to the next, maybe doing a FaceTime in between for commercials or whatever. So it's been a lot of that and a lot of data being eaten up in the house. But either way, it's cool. It's interesting. But I mean, it's nothing that compares to being with amongst a bunch of people. And watching it as a group. That was a lot of fun last year. So definitely different times for sure. But either way, man, we're trying to enjoy it.
What was your favorite episode to watch and to participate in? So there was the The first one, which is at the Griffith Observatory, then you go to the beach. Then there's the Jonathan Gold episode. Then there's the art episode, which I did not love that one. Then there's the trolls episode when you had to do the veggies. Later in the day, you had to do the loved ones episode. And then two episodes ago, it was the Philharmonic, LA Philharmonic, Gustavo, our guy Gustavo. And then this most recent one with Stephanie and Kevin Bame doing the judges of your pitch. So what episode stands out to you as favorite, least favorite, things that stood out to you, or things you want to kind of – the viewers at home didn't get a complete picture of what Eric did that episode that you want to straighten for the record.
Oh, man. My favorite episode was definitely the favorite challenge was the when we had to do the vegetarian menu. That was really cool. I think everyone was kind of in their element, felt really good about it.
Really?
There was a good energy for sure. And it was not just me, like everyone, even though it was obviously an intense situation.
I thought it was cheating by you and Nini, because most desserts don't have meat in it. So you're basically running out your best dessert dish.
Essentially. Yeah. So that was probably one thing that, when they brought it up, I was excited to do dessert anyway. And I wanted to take it, but that's a really good point. Nini herself, she's just like a pastry savant. So it was a no brainer for either one of us. But then I think the most fun, we talked about a little bit, is just the family challenge. That was cool to have everybody, loved one come in, take some edge off as well, during the competition, and just kind of, you know, seeing people in their most natural element with people that they love the most. Episode that sucked for me was the last for sure. I just fell on my face, man. It was something that, you know, it's funny because you hear the conversation about rest versus rust. And I definitely think that, you know, the getting some more rest and some more reps in, or not rest, but yeah, getting some more reps, some rest in would have definitely helped out, for me, just thinking in the long run. But yeah, it was tough, man. That was a tough challenge to be in, and kind of, again, knowing how I was feeling before they even started, it definitely led into everything that we saw, you know, on the television. As far as things that get like, man.
Yeah, straight for the record. This is your chance.
Straight for the record.
Your chance.
I don't know, man. There wasn't a lot, to be honest, man. I think there's so much that doesn't get caught. Like, even you think about it, like, Tom coming in and you know, during our challenges and talking to us, you don't really see that happen often. I think it happened might have happened once during the museum challenge, but there was a lot of stuff that gets cut off. But it's also like a lot of stuff that's hard to remember, man. And these days are like 18 hours long. They can be.
Who's your roommate? Anything from the living situation that?
It was Kevin and Brian Voltaggio. So it was all three of us in a room. And that was great, man. Just watching those two freaking frack, man, just from season six, they were hilarious to be around, obviously because they knew each other and have worked with each other for so long. But it was cool to get to know Kevin on a personal side and Brian just to continue on our relationship and really, you know, deepen that. And that was an awesome experience. So just living in the house was pretty cool. And then right across the hall, we had Leanne, Stephanie, and Karen, Nini, and Melissa.
Before we go, anything you care to share, care to plug?
Man, just really bringing some awareness to the industry right now is definitely the calling card for me. A lot of us right now, as far as chefs and restaurateurs, necessarily can't see the light, you know, and really are trying to find some ways, whether it be governmental assistance, or just even, again, awareness to the industry, man. I hope that we can all come back stronger than ever once this is all said and done. I'm definitely looking forward to, but yeah, James Beard Foundation.
Yeah. What's the best way we can help?
James Beard Foundation is doing an awesome job leading the industry. World Central Kitchen is doing a great job as well, leading the industry. So catch up with them, hopping on their websites, try to figure out if there's anything that you can do as far as monetary donations, or just kind of bringing awareness to your local congressmen and women. So yes, the James Beard Foundation and definitely World Central Kitchen for sure.
Yeah. I want to see everybody come back healthy. All the restaurants, all the people sure. associated with them. I mean, I would be lying if I said I don't have great fear of what might happen to what I think has been just, I mean, restaurants have been on a winning streak for 15, 20 yeah. years in this country. Yeah. I just, the amount of creative energy, I just don't want to see it go away. Like, I don't want to drive down streets and see vacancies.
I know, man. That's the scary thought about it. So we're doing all that we can. Right now I'm working with a meal delivery service called Territory Foods. And we're giving proceeds to the James Beer Foundation. We're also doing donations for our first responders. And just want to mention them and say thank you as well. So yeah, man, just doing everything that I can from my home and quarantined and really just trying to make an impact. But I can't wait to break out and serve some people some doubles. And expand on everything that's going on, man. I'm really excited for the rest of the year, but excited to do it in a safe space.
Good luck. Thank you a ton for joining us.
Thank you, gentlemen. It was fun.
That was great. Thank you so much. And hopefully your Knicks get back onto the floor and win the championship next year.
Shout out to RJ Barrett, man. RJ's taking us there. All right, guys.
Thanks, Eric.
Take care, man.
Tom Haverstroh, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, let's catch up on the scoreboard here, because you had a great week, Kevin. You had You finally won a week, and it was a rough one for me. So Eric, not only did he get eliminated from the show, he got eliminated from Last Chance Kitchen too. So he got a -6. But Kevin, all of your chefs had at least 1 point. You got the 10 points from Kevin Gillespie. You had Nini with a top finish in the quick fire. Also, Karen, top finish in the quick fire. Stephanie gets immunity. Kevin, I just want to like recap here. That immunity might have been the biggest moment on the show so far, right? Like, because you, like you said, it bought her some time, not just from this episode, but next episode too. So Stephanie's going to be around for a bit, it looks like.
Yeah, and I do think she will be around. And as the challenges tend to get away from food fairs and towards singular plates, I'm curious to see, because I think she excels in that form. And there's a lot of, you can tell the collective respect for her. But I'm watching Melissa, Gregory, and Kevin just ball out. I mean, they're just, it's unbelievable. I don't know that we've ever seen a tier like this.
It's incredible. I did some research here. So of the last 5 seasons through 7 episodes, here's how many winners, the number of winners we've seen. Last year, we saw through 7 episodes, 5 different winners. Season before that, 6. Season before that, 6. Season before that, 4. And season before that was 8. And that season was Melissa was in that season. And in the first 7 episodes of that season, when there were 8 winners, she was not one of them.
She was a hanging around contestant. That was her.
That was her. So the fact that she is not just getting the just admiration from Eric and the rest of the fans out there, but she is incredible. And she hung around. And then finally started coming on at the end. But this season, she's been remarkable. So let's a quick thing here. Brian Malarkey, last 2 episodes, has really come on and done a pretty good job here. Your thoughts after his performance this week?
Well, yeah, if I'm looking correctly, he is right behind. I mean, Gregory in the last 3 weeks, Gregory and Kevin with 25 points, Melissa with 24. And then who's next? Brian Malarkey. So look, he's a creative chef. The food tends to taste good. I mean, we're seeing that. If he takes away 2 ingredients a dish, he's not going to go home. I think he's going to do fine in the front of the house, like famous last words, but I think he'll do a good job in the front of the house next week. You know, as I told you, I'm acclimating to the shtick, but I don't see any backsliding momentum for this guy.
No, he's got 17 total points in 5th place behind Brian Voltaggio, who's in a little bit of a rut here. So I have 4 chefs remaining. I have Gregory, Brian Voltaggio, Melissa, and Leanne. And you have Kevin, Nini, Karen, Stephanie, and Malarkey. So that is 5 episodes or 5 chefs to my 4. You're down 93 I have 129, but the deficit is closing. You get 20 points for the first time clearing that 20-point plateau, and I had a measly 12, my season low 12. So you get a season high with 20, a season low for me. The gap is closing, Kevin, 129 to 93. Still got a whole lot of Top Chef
like,
left this
season.
Like
a glacier, it's closing. I mean, it's Tom, excited for Restaurant Wars next week. I mean, it's come on. It's always the centerpiece episode, even more than the finale. Everybody loves Restaurant Wars. Psyched that it's bound back down to two, old school. Any closing thoughts from the closing thoughts?
We have another guest lined up for next week that we're really excited about. And big, big shout out to Eric for joining us again. And I really want to see this Restaurant Wars because, man, it never disappoints. And here we go with another twist. Can't wait for it, Kevin.
For Tom Haberstroh, I'm Kevin Ornemitz. This is Pack Your Knives.